Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today I talked to Dina Ladd, a workers' rights advocate who works with the Workers' Action Center in Toronto, as well as other groups. Continuing our series of interviews marking 1 year since the beginning of the pandemic, we turn this week to the topic of work, especially essential work. Lucky are the ones who get to work at home, but there are still thousands of people in Ontario that have to go to a physical work location every day, and they are putting themselves in danger of catching COVID-19 in the process. Are these people being protected like they should? And who is looking out for them? Dina Ladd will consider those and other questions, since working during COVID is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Around this time last year, Deborah DeAngelis of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union appeared on the Guelph Politicast to talk about the burden put on people that work in the newly deemed essential business categories like grocery stores and big box stores. Almost overnight, because of the pandemic, those workers, who are almost all minimum wage earners, were seen as heroes. They started receiving better pay, more benefits, and were heralded for holding up the economy and delivering vital goods and services to the community in a difficult time. DeAngelis was optimistic. After years of struggle to get service industry work recognized as a real work and not just a refuge for students and stay-at-home moms looking for pocket money, things were finally starting to change. Of course, such optimism was short-lived as summer arrived and the number of new cases fell. Loblaw, Sobeys, and Walmart all reconsidered their pandemic pay and other compensation. Even during the second wave, which was bigger and deadlier than the initial phase of the pandemic, those corporations largely kept the status quo, while the provincial government repeatedly refused a bipartisan request to increase workplace safety and initiate mandatory paid sick days. This is not a new story for Dina Ladd, who has been fighting for workers' rights for over 20 years now. She's advocated for improved wages and working conditions. She's sought better protections for migrant workers. She's taught workers how to advocate and unionize. And she's protected people of color in precarious jobs who have nowhere else to go. It's hard to think of a better person to talk about this subject with, the subject of work during COVID. So this week on the Guelph Politicast, we're joined by Dina Ladd, who will share her overall thoughts about COVID's effect on work in the last year, the common issues and worker concerns she's hearing about right now, and how she thinks work will be forever changed because of the pandemic. We will also talk about the political side of fighting for workers' rights, the difficulty in developing solidarity with all workers, and her thoughts on the pandemic response from both the federal and provincial governments. And finally, Ladd will discuss her concerns about post-pandemic austerity, how we can change perspectives on the ways we value work, and how not much has changed for migrant workers in Ontario's farmers' fields as this growing season begins. So I caught up with Dina Ladd a couple of weeks ago via Zoom. So Dina Ladd, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Maybe to just start really, you know, in a super general way, we're kind of, as we're recording this, we have just passed the 1 year mark of the WHO's declaration of the pandemic. Been a tough year for all kinds of workers, all kinds of places. How do you, you know, when you think about all that you've been doing the last year as a workers advocate, you know, what are some of the things that have stuck out to you, like the problems, the lessons, just, you know, what kind of year has it been in terms of work?
Wow, that's a big question. I mean, I think that it's been a year of being incredibly worried and stressed out for many of the workers that we are connect with. Because pre-pandemic, we work with workers who are non-union, right? We work with workers who get paid cash, are working through temp agencies, are, you know, finding it hard to even get paid minimum wage, are struggling with employment standards violations. And so all of those issues, all of the kinds of stresses and strains on workers around precarious employment were so much part of people's lives. In fact, you know, just before even the pandemic, we had a sort of every day we would get groups of workers, mainly undocumented, mainly doing cleaning, construction, who were coming with stories of unpaid wages and being threatened with deportation if they said anything about those unpaid wages. So that was the context by which we entered the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
We also entered the pandemic with our labor laws significantly weak. We had managed to get some protections in 2018, which were all rolled back by the Ford government. And so we entered this pandemic with no paid sick days, with any kind of labor improvements gone. Hmm. And so, as you can imagine, when it started to hit, in particular, the Chinese community, and we started to see a lot of workers contacting us, lost their work, not able to get employment insurance, wondering about what was going to happen, if there was any going to be any relief efforts by the government. Those things didn't really even kick in until April. Mm. So we had a sort of, a good 3 months of complete sheer panic around what was going to happen to all of these workers who were already dealing with not a lot of wages, precarious employment, struggling to make ends meet. So the biggest driver for us as worker organizers, as advocates, was how do we get people through this? How do we ensure that they can keep a roof over their heads? How can we ensure that they have food? How do we make sure that, people have the support to kind of deal with their employers on a daily basis around, following public health guidelines? So really, it has been sort of a roller coaster of emotions. And every time the federal income security benefits come to an end, it's this complete sort of panic by thousands and thousands of workers wondering what they're going to do as those benefits come to an end. And then, of course, there's a bit of a relief when those things get dealt with. So yeah, so I think that was a very long answer, but I think it's not been an easy road, that's for sure.
It's a long answer, but I think it's an insightful answer too, because a lot of the things you're talking about, workers dealing with at the beginning of the pandemic, they are dealing with now. And in that regard, not much has changed in a year for workers in that regard.
100%. And so we are still in a situation where workers entering into the pandemic had no paid sick days. We still have no paid sick days. We still have not seen the fundamental changes that we need to sectors such as long-term care and an improvement of wages and working conditions for, say, personal support workers. We haven't seen any sort of long-term guidelines around whether those income benefits, those COVID emergency benefits, will be there until the end of the year. Yet we know that many of the sectors like live entertainment, tourism, they're absolutely not going to be in operation if we're lucky, before Christmas. but I think generally we're talking about 2022. We're starting to see, we just heard today that Sudbury is now on lockdown because of the third wave. That's going to be hitting many different communities again across the country. So in that kind of environment, the kind of role that governments can play to bring security, stability, safety to workers is really quite important. I think we've seen the rising numbers of anxiety, depression, stress from children to adults grow exponentially during the pandemic. So, our job as worker advocates is trying to sort of take off some of those concerns and allow workers to just be able to do what they have to do to survive this.
Perhaps to set a baseline of expectations, the government response, both the federal and the provincial government here in Ontario, how would you grade those responses?
Well, I would say that we have been pleasantly surprised by the federal government's response. I think it's been a relief to have a baseline of $500 a week set as our income benefits. I think we were incredibly worried that they were going to just throw people at the mercy of what the EI system was, and that was that would have been an awful mistake. Mm-hmm. And so I think I speak for many workers who have relied on CERB, and now it's called CRB, that it has been a massive lifeline for workers to be able to at least cover some of the basics. Obviously, for families who have a lot of dependents or, you know, huge medical expenses, it's not enough, but it has provided a lifeline. I think their attempt to bring in a sickness benefit, I think has to be applauded. And frankly, they've had to do it because the provincial governments across this country have not stepped up and have not done what they should have. So I think on the whole, I think the federal government could move on improving labor standards for federally regulated workers and ensure, you know, 10 paid sick days for federally regulated workers, even though the provinces won't do it. So they haven't taken that step. But on the whole, with the kind of income security benefits, that has been amazing. I think the one massive flaw in that plan has been supports to migrant workers who don't have a valid social insurance number. We need to make sure in a pandemic, it doesn't matter what your immigration status is, if you're going to work and you can't take care of your health, then that's a problem for everyone. And if there's one thing we've learned during this pandemic is the health of the cleaner, the health of the personal support worker matters, right? It matters to everyone. And we can't just say, oh, that's not my problem. The pandemic is everyone's problem. I think provincially, it has been a huge disappointment. The Ford government has failed on so many levels, from instituting adequate, seamless paid sick days, ensuring that the role and leadership that they could play in long-term care and healthcare just has absolutely not happened. You know, to sort of put people at the mercy of landlords at this moment has been terrible. Recognizing that people needed that people couldn't pay their rent at the beginning of the pandemic, why that was not thought through in the second wave, I have no idea. We have more businesses that have closed down, so of course people are going to lose their jobs. There's going to be a higher unemployment. Why you can't protect people from being evicted at this particular moment during the winter months is astounding to me. So I have to give them a big F, because it's been shocking how they have failed us on so many levels and have kept putting the responsibility on the federal government and then not using the resources that they have been given to support our communities to be kept safe.
I think there's almost an across the board failure too, especially as we've seen in the second wave. And maybe you can speak to this, but I remember those initial few months last year, you had the grocery stores, the big box stores that were essential businesses staying open, but paying their workers more, offering them a bit more benefits. But I mean, as soon as, you know, summer hit, June, July, those benefits came off. What we did not see is that during the second wave, when things were measurably worse, the benefits coming back, or even just, you know, keeping the benefits and paying those workers a living wage, which would have been more ideal. But I mean, even at that, we saw this a second state of emergency, but we didn't see a second similar reaction from, I mean, you mentioned the provincial government, of course, but even just from private businesses who depend on those workers to keep their stores open.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think given the fact that the rates of infection have been worse in the second round than the first, the fact that, you know, And let's face it, we've been all hearing the stories of the places where essential workers work, working in companies that are doing very well profit-wise. You know, Sobeys just, you know, just announced their profits have gone up. We've heard the same thing from Metro, Loblaws, you know, Amazon. I mean, you know, the profit margins have gone up for those essential jobs, but they've decided to not share that with the workers who do that frontline work and who, you know, have to think about, okay, I'm going in for my 5-hour shift at, you know, $14.25 an hour and not getting that pandemic pay, which is absolutely shocking. I think what we also didn't see is, you know, during the first round, we received nonprofit community groups received COVID emergency funding to provide food boxes and PPE and income supports and you know, things like Wi-Fi. We did not get that in the second round at all. So we've literally had to just rely on those resources from the first round. And so that has also been quite difficult because as we start to see the impact of the third wave, what does that mean to our communities? I mean, people's savings have been wiped out. Any kind of any extra that they had in the first round and the second round is now gone. And what worries me is the state of unemployment that people are going to be facing when they go back out into the workforce, that, you know, we'll have this massive competition for jobs when income benefits all run out. And it's going to mean a sort of a downward pressure on wages and working conditions. We've already seen this in the labor market. Employers know that there's a lot of people looking for work right now. So I think that, the supports have really not been there in the second wave, and I don't see them there for the third wave either.
Mm-hmm. But you've already phrased an issue, which is a lot of people think once we get vaccinated, we're going to more or less pick up where we left off. And, you know, you hear from some people who work in business and, you know, people who own their own businesses, people who are, you know, frequent travelers, they know they're not going to be getting back into planes and going and flying to, you know, Calgary for the business conference this year. They're not going to have the annual industry trade show at the Metro Toronto Convention Center. And that will have a impact on hotels, people employed at hotels, people who are employed cleaning up the convention centers and this kind of thing, like airline travelers. There will not be a point where we're like, okay, we've gotten to the herd immunity, the 3/4, everybody's vaccinated and everything's back to normal. There is going to be that crunch for a while.
Absolutely. I think that anyone thinking of traveling is not planning on doing so for quite still some time yet. And so all those secondary and tertiary businesses that are connected to traveling, as you said, in addition, you know, hospitality, restaurants, all those, the catering companies that provide the meals on the planes, all of those things will not be at full capacity for some time. I think most of us can also see when we're walking around our neighborhoods of the businesses that have closed down, you know, of the companies that have just gone down, and those jobs will not be available either. And so, so even if the economy starts running up again, let's say just before Christmas or right after Christmas, people are expecting to come back to work maybe half time, maybe, you know, a third of their shifts. And then slowly, you know, probably by the fall of 2022, I think, you know, we're all hoping that things go back. But the longer these strains continue and the longer the vaccination rollouts happen, this all gets delayed. And so for workers, that means another year and a half of instability. And so I think it's really important for the leadership at the provincial and federal government level to sort of be able to not just wait till the last minute, but to be able to show a clear path ahead of how they are going to support workers returning into the labor market and providing the necessary supports, but also starting to really change the labor standards that exist. Because, you know, we need to fundamentally change the labor practices that exist in many of the sectors that workers have gotten infected in. You know, this the creation of so many part-time jobs, not having a basic labor standard such as paid sick days, you know, the role of temp agencies in moving people from job to job to job, or and not people not having a voice to speak out. These things have to fundamentally change, because we've seen the incredible damage it's done in long-term care and in many of the other sectors where there've been outbreaks. And I think that, you know, we need to start not waiting for this magic moment for the pandemic to be over. Why can't we start making those fundamental changes now so that workers, when they do go back to work, feel more secure and have more protection?
Well, I think that's a fundamental question. And I remember talking to an organizer with the UFCW, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. I want to make sure I got my initials right. Yeah. but, you know, I remember talking, it wasn't around this time last year, but it was shortly thereafter. It was like right in the middle of the first wave. And there was a lot of optimistic discussion with her about, you know, we appreciate essential workers now. We are rewarding essential workers with, if not a great wage, at least a living wage, as conventionally understood, by, you know, showing our appreciation to them, by calling them essential. And then as soon as it was kind of opportune to not give them the danger pay anymore, it all comes off and it never came back. And I one of the things I've been struggling with as, you know, someone interested in labor issues, if the pandemic doesn't change this, what does?
I think that's a really good question. I think the question lies with all of us, to be honest. I think there's a certain point where you expect government to listen to you and hear what people are saying. But I have to say, around the paid sick days discussion, for instance, there has been medical officer after medical officer, you know, mayor after mayor, doctor after doctor, who has basically said, you know, you need to have a provincial paid sick day program combined with the federal program. That is what's going to protect workers. And the provincial government has basically just said, we're not interested. We don't care. We think it's a duplication. And so many people have said, it's not a duplication. These are two different programs. And so at the end of the day, people say, have said to me, you know, like, what, like, they're not going to do it. So what's the point of asking for it? But I think that then that's our responsibility as a community, because I'm hoping that that public consciousness that has been raised around the types of jobs that we didn't really pay attention to, that we just took for granted, that that public consciousness has to translate into an improvement. It's kind of like the conversation we've been having about climate change. You know, you can ignore it for as long as you can, but then when you start, like, you know, having no snow in winter, which is what Toronto has had, no snow in the winter months at all, and we had 19 degrees yesterday, like, it kind of makes you wonder about climate change and about what we're going to do. And so to me, I think it's our collective responsibility to now not leave it to the politicians. It's our collective responsibility to say, I don't want my neighbor who works at a grocery store to go to work and only get 10 hours of work a week and be paid minimum wage and have no paid sick days. It's my responsibility to fight for her better working conditions. And I think that collective responsibility has to happen. And our job, I mean, I'll say my job as someone who's an organizer, is about talking to people in my community and across this province to say, you know, how are you going to step up? How are you going to support the personal support workers in your long-term care home? How are you going to support the grocery store workers and the cleaners? in the local libraries or in the local government buildings. What are you going to do? And I think that that's a question that we have to ask ourselves. And I have to say the provincial elections are happening in June of 2022. Mm. That's just over a year from now. And I think that we need to be paying strong attention to who we elect and whether or not they are going to listen to what we've learned, the collective experience that we've learned through this pandemic. And our job is to make them know that there will be serious consequences for them if they are not willing to take leadership and step up for what's needed to be done. And that is our collective responsibility. And so I'm really hoping that people remember these issues and remember the fact that there needs to be significant leadership on this, on protecting our communities. So I'm not willing to wait for the politicians anymore. I'm going to be organizing, hopefully, with many of my neighbors and community members, and saying, you know, this is not good enough, what we've seen, right?
I remember the online commentary, shall we say, when the former Liberal government introduced the $15 minimum wage and increasing it to the $15 minimum wage, and there was a lot of discussion about, oh, well, someone who works the cashier at Walmart is going to make as much as I, who's, you know, gotten this training and went to college for 2 years to get my diploma and all that. That kind of went away when the pandemic struck. That discussion, that whole equalization discussion, like the work of a person who works at Walmart or Costco or Sobeys or wherever is not equal to my work. All of a sudden, people understood that work is equal and essential.
Yes.
And
yes.
I guess the next step then is to, how do we translate that into a movement, into a broader labor movement?
Yes. And I think it's about, as you say, it's about valuing people's work. It's about, so many times we're sort of trying to be better than the next person, and to sort of have someone that we kind of, you know, that we're better than. And I think that the pandemic showed us that all of these incredible essential workers were willing to go to work during the pandemic and allow, you know, many of us to stay at home. And that had value, right? That has value. That has value in so many ways. Because they have families too. And I think that, you know, that kind of consciousness, I think I'm hoping will translate into people not necessarily seeing that they have to go up against each other, but it's about lifting everyone up and about ensuring that all of us should be able to be safe during a pandemic and have the kinds of decent wages that we're talking about. And I agree with you, because I think one of the other things that we just saw this past, I think it was on Monday actually, is that a collection of employer groups and unions have gotten together to say that personal support workers should be paid $25 an hour. Partly it's because they can't find enough workers to go into people's homes, because people are doing it for, you know, $16, $17 an hour. So I'm hoping that those kinds of, you know, the fact that we value, that we're going to value care work more, healthcare work, and not just in a hospital, but in all of the kinds of facilities in our communities, and that more attention gets paid to the role that women play, and especially a lot of women of color who do this work at really bad wages and bad working conditions, because not only are they making low wages, they have no health benefits and no paid sick days. And they don't get paid for travel time between clients when they're going to visit people at home. So they're really taking on a lot of those wages and working conditions on themselves. So I'm hoping that what we're going to start to see is a more of a collective understanding that decent wages and working conditions translates into health, and good health is then good for the community. And so that to me, it would be an incredible silver lining to come out of this, if there can be one.
I think one of the things that, I always see happening as kind of an observer is whatever unity is created in the labor movement is susceptible to the outside pressures of, you know, things like austerity. And I think that's probably a concern you have, and maybe you can talk a bit about it. But, you know, the job crunch you're talking about, where there are more workers than jobs, and so businesses will offer jobs for the lowest possible wage because they know somebody's going to take it because they're desperate enough for a job. I guess if the intention here is to speak with one voice about promoting the cause of advancing labor, those things that kind of split us apart in the end, it's very easy to step on that crack and make it a fracture. I guess how do we avoid that kind of thing? How do we keep solidarity front and center?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think this is going to be a huge struggle ahead when we see that downward pressure on wages and working conditions. I think also combined with, governments starting to introduce austerity measures and cuts to public services because, you know, money has gone to, you know, the wage subsidy program or income supports and those kinds of things. I think we're going to have to really be vigilant and very intentional about ensuring that we're not pitted against each other. And I think that, I think it's going to be a struggle. I think it's going to be a real struggle, to be honest. I think that it's really important for us to stand up for public services. Again, I think that we've seen during this pandemic that all the cuts that the Harper government made to employment insurance meant that the system could not handle what happened during this pandemic and why it's so important to have good quality public services and healthcare. So I think that it's gonna mean a lot of intentional, good leadership. I think a lot of coalition work and alliances and networking to make sure that that happens. But it's not going to be easy.
It's also not going to be easy because the immediate reflex for a lot of people is to go back to whatever normal was too. That it's the, I guess the desire is that anything that anything that from the pandemic that we let change us is bad because the pandemic was bad, and anything that comes out of the pandemic is automatically bad too.
Well, hopefully a lot of unions and a lot of community groups have realized the importance of not letting the government cut back and, you know, allow concessions and allow the kind of erosion that's happened in our public services and in, you know, in the kinds of conditions. I think it's going to be we're in for a real road ahead. I think it's going to be really tough. I think that there's going to be all kinds of ways in which government spending that got us through the pandemic will be used against the federal government to now justify massive cuts. And I think we have to just basically say, there are decisions you can make in terms of where you put your money and put your dollars. Don't take it out of public services. And, you know, like, you know, there's been a whole conversation around, defunding the police and about sort of, you know, should all of the millions and millions of dollars go towards policing? Why can't we take some of that and put it into mental health services and into, you know, all the kinds of neighborhood programs that kids need to get off the streets that have been cut back, right? Local neighborhood center programming, all of the things that, you know, are really critical to engage our youth and to ensure that neighborhoods that are especially struck with poverty and will be even more worser off in the years ahead have the kinds of infrastructural support in schools and in community centers. So those are the kinds of political decisions that our politicians will, that we need to influence our politicians about.
You do a lot of work with those undocumented workers. You talked about earlier, the people who are working on farms and doing that kind of work. what does this season look like for them? That I mean, versus last season especially, but also, you know, versus the demands and the dangers for them going into this year, what does that look like?
So unfortunately, it is looking the same. We are seeing outbreaks on farms. There's a number of big outbreaks happening on farms. The situation of workers who challenged conditions last year and who spoke out about the unsafe conditions, there is a challenge about them being able to come back into the country, and which is horrific. Workers are again being put on farms and being isolated and not given enough of the like groceries and sort of infrastructural things that they should have had. So again, it speaks to the structural issues for farm workers as well as other temporary foreign workers coming in through those programs, that, you know, if you're good enough to come into this country to work for 8 months of the year, you're good enough to get status. Many of the workers that have been coming in through the seasonal agricultural workers program have been coming in for 10, 15, 20 years, and yet they are denied citizenship. They're denied the ability to bring their families over, even though they've contributed significant amounts, the majority of the year in this country. So the rules in immigration that led to the kinds of outbreaks that we saw in you know, the first wave have not fundamentally changed at all. We have, through the organizing efforts by incredible migrant workers, we've managed to get permits and, you know, extended work permits for a lot of international students at Christmas time. But in terms of fundamentally opening up the pathways for residency for migrant workers, which would make a huge difference, the government hasn't moved on that. And so that is what we intend to organize. And obviously groups like the Migrant Workers Alliance for Change and the Migrant Rights Network and organizations like that have been doing absolutely phenomenal work in supporting workers to actually speak out about the conditions that they face. And so there was an incredible action just even a week or two ago of 200 farm workers saying, like, we need status, we need the ability to bring our families over. We don't want to die on the farms. We need proper oversight. We need protection. And because those workers are coming from the South, where, you know, conditions are horrendous. And this risk is better than the risk that they have back home. And it's what kind of choice is that? It's no choice.
Yeah. How much of it, like, any of the stuff you deal with is like kind of like a matter of political will? Because, you know, helping undocumented farm workers, that is immediately going to get a very loud voice talking about a very loud, let's call it a very loud anti-immigration voice that unfortunately too many people in the government listen to. You know, things like spending on social programs that gets a certain constituency excited about deficit spending and adding to the debt and all that. And that makes a certain politician start to wince about all the spending and maybe not step up and support those programs. I mean, it just, how do we solve the political problem? Because again, we're coming full circle on the interview, is like, these are problems that have persisted for years. The pandemic has arrived, exacerbated some, and it's just a matter of like, what creates real change from this point? And how do we get politicians on board to help create substantive change in these areas?
I mean, it's difficult because in some ways you're dealing with really deep-rooted systemic racism, frankly, that is embedded in our immigration system and embedded in who we see value as giving citizenship to. You know, our immigration history in this country has been racist in terms of who we've allowed in and who we see as value or not. And so, you know, we see the government speaking out of both sides of its mouth. On one hand, they say, well, if you look at the demographics, We have the largest group of seniors than we've ever had before. We need immigrants coming into this country. You have employers saying, we can't find workers in Canada. That's why we need to bring people over through the Temporary Foreign Workers Program. We have no choice. Nobody wants to do these jobs. So that's what you hear on one side. And then on the other side, we hear all of these incredibly negative comments about basically people from the South who don't have white skin, to be honest, coming into the country. So, you know, you don't see the backlash against the Irish that are coming in. We have a huge influx of people from Ireland coming into this country. And, the government is spending a lot of money wooing, workers from that country. But nobody really sort of pays any attention to them. And most of them are allowed to come in and get access to PR. But for many of us from the South, the only way you can come in is through tied to an employer. And that immediately weakens your ability to speak up against any working conditions, any violations of your rights, and you can get deported just like that. And we saw that during the pandemic where, a farm worker spoke up around the conditions, and the next minute he's being driven to the airport and being put on a plane back to Mexico. That is what happens to workers. And so I think that, we have to fundamentally challenge the systemic racism of our labor market and of our immigration policies. We have to allow people to come in with status and bring the kinds of experiences that they do. I mean, I think about myself, and obviously from my British accent, you'd think I was white, but I'm actually South Asian from England. I was born there, but my family came over in the late 1980s. My dad was a car mechanic. My mum was an office worker, but we got into Canada and we got access to the PR. But now if my family was to come into this country, I would not be able to come in. I would not get in. I would have to come through either the international student route, I could find myself a job in a meatpacking plant or in one of the lovely industries that use migrant labor, because apparently nobody wants to do those jobs here. And I wouldn't get citizenship. I would be sent home after my stint here. So I think that we, do we really want an immigration system where every 20 years the government has to apologize for the horrendous racist treatment of certain groups of workers? Because that's literally what the history is. It's like, okay, who are you going to apologize this year to in terms of the fundamental, racist treatment? So I think that, again, what immigration organizers have been doing have been kind of trying to expose this contradiction, the racism, the kinds of treatment. And I think, again, it's our collective responsibility to say, are we okay with that? Like, we're okay to have, all of our food picked by these, men and women of color from Jamaica, from Mexico, from Guatemala. And we're okay with them for eight months of the year, but then bye-bye, we don't want you in this country anymore. Like, we have to look at, we have to really examine, what allows the ability of the government to get away with this kind of systemic abuse, and the fact that they are not fundamentally challenged by Canadians about it, right? Mm. What does that say about our communities? The fact that this has been going on for 51 years and this treatment has never really been fundamentally challenged by our communities. But we are seeing a huge recognition through the pandemic of these inequities and of this kind of racially segregated workforces that exist in our communities. And, people have to step up. They can't keep this going because, you can't just point to the US and say, oh my God, look what they're doing down there. It's terrible. It's been happening here for years. We also have detention centers that take children away from immigrant families. And that's alive and kicking here as well. It's not just in the US. But we like to think that, we're a nicer, gentler kind of people. north of the US, which is absolutely not true.
One of the things I will note, and maybe it's as a point to wrap up on, is, you know, one of the things coming out of last summer and the whole Black Lives Matter resurgence and those marches, and one of the reasons why that came on so strong, yes, because of some very vicious things that happened in the United States, but also because people were able to take the time and sort of marinate on those issues because they had that extra time sitting at home, not going out, not hanging out with friends. Is there a similar sense in your mind about, like, these kind of worker issues now that people sort of have the time to, you know, to mull over these issues in their head and maybe explore them in their own lives a bit more, that we're kind of more receptive to these things you have spent a career lobbying against?
I have to say, yeah, I mean, we have received a massive amount of support, more support than we've ever done in seen before pre-pandemic. I think just even around the paid sick days, the incredible public support for paid sick days and people getting active in the issue has been incredible. Same thing around the migrant workers issue. Same thing around, you know, pushing on anti-Black racism. And I think that absolutely all of those signs are incredibly positive. We've also have seen a massive increase in people getting involved in our organization. Workers who are directly impacted by bad jobs and poor working conditions, who say, I want to do something about it. So that is what gives me hope. I think that the courage of people to, you know, sort of say, I don't feel good about this anymore. I'm going to do something. We've seen huge mutual aid kind of networks, people taking responsibility for their neighborhoods, this sense, more sense of collective community responsibility of reaching out, supporting your neighbor. That's all incredibly good. And I think that all of those experiences of especially around mutual aid and that, you know, not waiting for governments to just do everything, but people actually taking the initiative and leadership themselves to get involved and to become involved in these fights really bodes well for our communities and keeps me optimistic. I have so many people contacting me all the time and sort of wanting to get involved. That is fantastic. And I think that that's why I think that, you know, politicians should be paying attention, because I think that they're going to see a real change in the sort of typical electioneering that happens when those elections take place in the next little while. I think the conversations are going to be very different. People are going to be asking very different questions, are going to be asking questions of where were you when this was taking place? And I think that that bodes really well for our collective movement of challenging these like deep inequities in our communities. So yeah, it's very inspiring, and that's what I think keeps us all going, right?
I think you're right, and we'll have to leave it there because the work never stops. But Dina Ladd, thank you so much for all your time today and for all your hard work representing all the workers out there. I know it's appreciated, and I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
And once again, that was Dina Ladd. You can follow her on Twitter at Dina Ladd. And you can learn more about the work and advocacy of the Workers Action Center at its website, workersactioncenter.org. Keep in mind that under the Canadian Labour Code, you do have the right to refuse dangerous work. And if you do encounter an issue at your workplace, you can file a complaint with the Ontario Labour Board by calling toll-free at 1-877-202-0008. That is 1-877-202-0008. And that is it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics at Sid Dale. The Guelph Politicast is usually recorded at CFRU at the University Center on the University of Guelph campus. And to learn more about CFRU, go to cfru.ca. You can download the Guelph Politicast on Wednesday from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. or you can download it from the host at Podbean at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. When you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, wherever you get it, you will also get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Fridays. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. I'm on Twitter at adamadonaldson or at Guelph Politico. There is also the Guelph Politico Facebook page, which you can find at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you next week. And until then, we will see you next time.